A very good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for joining. The chapter of Tehillim that I chose for this month in preparation for Shavuos and on the topic of Sfira is chapter 15 in Tehillim. I always found that when the children come home from yeshiva, from Hebrew school, Sunday school, they come home with this Sfira counter to count from Pesach to Shavuos, the 49 days, and invariably the count goes winding its way up the mountain. And somehow that is the figurative way that we prepare for Shavuos. As we know, every year, not only are we commemorating a time of old, but we are actually going through and experiencing that same energy every single year. On Rosh Hashanah, it's obvious. On Yom Kippur, it's obvious. It's a day of judgment. It once was a day of judgment, and now it's also a day of judgment. It once was a day of forgiveness, when Hashem said, Salachti on the Egel, on the golden calf. And now also, as we stand Yom Kippur, we ask for forgiveness. But where it's not as noticeable, and it takes ourselves to remind ourselves, that Sukkot, Pesach, Shavuos, Chanukah, Purim, is also a time of destiny regarding that same energy that was once experienced at that time, and we are experiencing it once again. We're scaling the mountain, symbolically climbing, getting ourselves ready for Shavuos, which is a major theme of this chapter. Everything that's valuable in this world requires preparation. They say a story of a certain person, I don't need to, you know, be disparaging, even though he was public about it, but he says he showed up in yeshiva, and he walks in and says, here I am! I'm ready! And the rabbi told him, that's not the way you come in over here. Here I am. You know, meditate a little bit. Sit in a corner, think about why you came. And then we'll give you an entrance exam. This preparation before anything. Here I am doesn't work. Doesn't work with dating, it doesn't work with marriage. Child rearing, people think it works. It needs preparation. It needs to be thought out. And coming into Shavuos is the same thing. Very dramatic. 49 days of counting. Anticipation. And then we're ready. Shabbos needs preparation. The world to come needs preparation. And that's the subject of this very chapter. The chapter begins, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Mizmor LeDavid, a psalm by David. We have the author, and he begins. Hashem, he's talking directly to Hashem, Mi yogur be'ohlecha, and he's posing a question. Who dwells in your tent? And the question seems to be repeated. Mi yishkon bahar kodshecha, who dwells in your holy mountain? Now, even though Tehillim is poetic and it sounds like it's repeating itself, the commentaries go to great lengths to try to figure out what David had in mind. Because David is not your songster, and he's not just strumming a guitar and repeating himself. He authored this with sanctity, with Ruach HaKodesh, with divine inspiration. Why does he repeat himself? Who dwells in your tent? Sounds temporary. Who will dwell in your holy mountain? Now, when we compare the first part with the second part, the tent with the mountain, it's clearly reminiscent of the symbolism that we have regarding the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. The Mishkan is a temporary dwelling that we had in the desert, makeshift. It was made as a tent-like structure, beams and cloth. Temporary, because they had to take it down every time they moved. They had to put it back up in the next location. That's the temporary form. What does that eventually lead to? The permanent structure, which is the Beit HaMikdash, Beis HaMikdash, which is on the mountain, and that's permanent. I mean, permanent until we didn't deserve it, then Hashem destroyed it. And then rebuilt, and eventually rebuilt a third time in the times of Mashiach, permanently. That same imagery of a Mishkan, a temporary dwelling, and a Beis HaMikdash, permanent dwelling, is the same symbolism that we use when we describe David's question. You have a temporary dwelling in this world. You have a firm dwelling place in the next world. And his question is, who deserves to dwell in your tent? Who deserves to dwell in your permanent dwelling? Why does David do this? He seems to repeat himself. He first starts with temporary, then he goes permanent. What's the point? So we have an old Jewish expression. A good question is half the answer. If you know how to ask the question well, so then you're already just inches from the right answer. David has a good question. Because David knows that if you want to get into the permanent dwelling of the future, you got to have a godly temporary dwelling. Because it leads up. If you're living in a temporary dwelling that's godly, then when you get to the permanent dwelling, it's also going to be godly. Right? I describe it as the magic trick of life. The magic trick of life is that the way you spend your time is the type of person you're going to be. And that's what's going to happen to you. A person at the end of life wonders why they have no relationship with their kids. Okay, hypothetically, you may have heard of such a thing. They wonder. And you ask, well, you tell me, how did you spend your Sunday? How did you spend your Shabbos? How did you spend your evenings? And if they answer, I worked. I was busy. I was making money for the family. Did you ever bike ride? Did you ever help the kids bike ride? Did you ever do the homework with them? So the magic trick of life is that very often, can't promise, but very often, usually, you work hard, you'll make money, you'll have money. Usually, more or less. Usually, if you spend time with your kids, then you've spent time with your kids, and you'll have a relationship with your kids. Usually, if you spend your Sunday or your Shabbos studying Torah, you'll eventually become knowledgeable in Torah. Usually, that's what happens. It's the magic trick of life. It's up to you to decide where to put your resources. David says, I know in my heart, but I have to figure out how to do it. But I know in my heart that if I create a godly tent, my temporary structure, then I will be assured that when I get to the permanent structure, it'll be a godly permanent structure. That's the magic trick. I once got a woman coming over to me that her child is 20, 21, dating non-Jewish, And just out of curiosity, I had no intention to rub anything in. I just asked, you know, did you ever discuss intermarriage with your kids? And she said, yeah, but that's about the only thing we ever did discuss. There was no Shabbos, there was no kashrus, there was no day school, there was nothing, except I used to preach to them, don't come home with a non-Jewish spouse. And she broke down crying. I mean, because she realized her mistake. If you want to project a permanent structure that's Jewish, then everything leading up to that has to be Jewish. And then it's a natural progression. David understands that. He says, who dwells in your holy tent? He like knows that's what's going to be required in order to get to who dwells in your holy mountain. And David, in a fascinating four psukim here, four verses, identifies what he believes are the key factors to run a warm Jewish home and in turn merit that the tent should be a natural transition, a lead up into the holy mountain. Now, what's fascinating here, as we do it, is you'll notice that David in this particular chapter does not talk about mitzvos ben adam lamakom. We know that there are two categories of mitzvos, right? Often we categorize mitzvos by the do's and the don'ts. But there's a different method of categorizing them. The actions that have to do with us and God, and the actions will have to do with us and our fellow, interpersonal. In this particular chapter, David only talks about interpersonal. I shouldn't be so strong to say only, because when he talks about value systems, bad people come in many forms. But when he gives examples, like he doesn't charge interest when he gives out a loan, he's talking about an interpersonal mitzvah. And Art Scroll, where this is taken from, indeed did the intro. The way to come closer to God is to be generous and honest towards man. And very interesting that David had no trouble isolating for the purposes of this chapter. If you want your entree, your opening into the holy tent, interpersonal, is what he focuses on. Now, that approach actually has a source in Jewish literature. It was later recorded in the Talmud. The Talmud tells us that a non-Jew came to Hillel and asked him, can you teach me all of Torah while I'm standing on one foot? This is the famous expression that has been borrowed in a variety of applications. I'm standing on one foot. Can you give it to me quick? We would call it microwave Torah. You know, I'm giving you 10 seconds. What can you do for me? And Hillel answered, what you don't like, don't do to your fellow. In other words, if you like something, you like other people to cooperate and allow you to have what you like. If you don't like it, you don't want them to thrust it upon you. You don't like insults. So Hillel is saying, so don't do that to other people either. Don't insult people. The Talmud says that that potential convert indeed grasped the whole thing and eventually became a righteous convert. Rashi over there asks, why was that an honest answer? What kind of answer is that? What you don't like, don't do to your friend. It's only half of the Torah. It's only the interpersonal mitzvahs. What happened to all the other mitzvahs between you and God? You have lots of mitzvahs. Shabbos, Kashrus, Mikvah, Tefillin, lots of mitzvahs between us and God, nothing interpersonal about them. And Rashi, in an astounding comment, says, God is also your friend. And if you can get into the habit of honoring your friend's wishes, whether it's a spouse, a neighbor, a coworker, a boss, anybody, kids, respecting someone else's wishes, then the progression will naturally develop to honoring Hashem's wishes as well. If Hashem says, you know, it's important to me that you do this mitzvah, so then you're in the habit of honoring someone else just like you like to be honored. David, in this introductory chapter to how to get into the holy tent, he has no trouble saying, focus on interpersonal. And if you do that, by definition, you'll become a giving person. And you'll be able to do all the mitzvahs. Pasuk Beis, verse 2. Holeich tamin. Number 1. A person should walk with Hashem in perfect innocence. Let's do the whole pasuk, the 3 items, and then we'll go back and explain. Ufoel tzedek, he should also do good. V'dover emes bilvavo, and he should speak truth in his heart. How do you speak truth in your heart? It's when you can't say it. Sometimes you can't say something, and you could only say it in your heart. Let's go back to the beginning of the verse. Holech tamim, a person is walking in innocence. Is that an action or a passive relationship? Holech tamim, a person walks innocently, passively. He's walking, but he's do. Okay. What would you expect of a person who's walking innocently? Let's say he encounters something he doesn't really like.
The body language, I guess.
Okay. There's a concept, very powerful, that because Hashem runs the world, and if I don't like something, what do? It's Hashem's world. I learn to accept it. That's one approach. You walk innocently, tamim. I'm not looking to make waves. I'm accepting what Hashem decided. That's one approach. That's the first part of the verse. The Chovas HaLevavos writes, for example, that a person should spend the time to listen to Hashem's messages. For example, if a person has certain talents that are inborn, it's Hashem's way of telling him what his mission in this world is. If he's artistic, so then something in that direction may very well be his calling. If he's not artistic, so going with innocence with Hashem means not to smash your head against the brick wall and insist that you must have this, what if it's not for you. Holech tamim, a person walking with innocence, listens to the messages, gets the feel. Hashem made me wealthy, so apparently he wants something I should do because of the type of person he made me. He made me poor. God forbid, we don't wish it on anyone. But that's also, it's a guide for me. What type of person am I supposed to be? The second part of the phrase is the flip side, though. Ufoel tzedek. But he's doing righteousness. And as much as the person who walks in perfect innocence may be described as a philosophically passive person. He's active, obviously. He makes decisions. But he's listening more than he's trying to change. The person who's a poel tzedek, who's doing the right thing, is actually making an impact and he's trying to change. I'll give you the example. The great Rabbi Akiva was once asked by the Roman governor, "You guys believe in God?" He says, "Yeah." We could be, accused of that. So the Roman governor says, "So then how do you give charity?" God made the person poor. Where do you come to give him sustenance? Clearly Hashem didn't want it that way. And Rabbi Akiva answered, "No, that's exactly what Hashem wants. Hashem created wealthy and poor, kedei sheyisku elu be'elu, so that each one should find merit in the other. The poor gets sustenance because rich people care about him, and the rich person gets merit because they're poor people in the world." To the point that in Jewish law, in halacha, the Rama words it, that poverty is a galgal hachozer ba'olam. It's a wheel. It's almost like, whose turn is it? And the Rama says, make sure to look after poor people, because if not you, your children or your grandchildren will be in need of that merit. Galgal hachozer, it's just a question of whose turn it is. I once walked into a certain business and I had a complaint. The product broke within 2 days of when I bought it. And I walked in and they walked to the back and they didn't realize I overheard what they said. But she says, "Whose turn is it to take complaints today? Whose turn is it to be supervisor today? So whose turn is it, God forbid, to be poor today?" That was Rabbi Akiva's perspective. Rabbi Akiva says, it's not holech tamim, let's go in innocence. If he's poor and he's starving, that's his mission in life. No! Poel tzedek. It's designed here for me to take action and try to change it. And a person, of course, as we know, has to have the wisdom to know the difference between when you're supposed to be a holech tamim, a person with innocence, to simply accept and appreciate what Hashem gave you, and also to be a poel tzedek. Sometimes, we know, you could change things, and you go ahead and change them. You could change the world. V'dover emes b'lvavo is the third part of this stanza. A person who speaks truth in his heart. Because sometimes you do not accept the situation as a holech tamim, walking in innocence. You know it's wrong. It's dead wrong. People are suffering. Situation is a miscarriage of justice. You know it's wrong and you're not willing to accept it. You don't feel this is God's plan for the world. You feel that this is mankind doing the wrong thing. So the second part of the pasuk would tell you, so do something about it. And you can't always do something about it. Sometimes the stress, the positioning, whatever it is, you're just not able at the moment to do something about it. So what do you do? What's the best you can do? Dover emes b'lvavo. Speak the truth in your heart. At least you need to know the difference between right and wrong. Tremendous concept.
But it says from his heart,
not in his heart. The Dover Emes, that's their translation. Bilvavo, in his heart.
It speaks the truth from his heart. That's what the English says.
Yeah, bilvavo means in his heart. The beis is in.
That's what I thought.
Normally that's how it is. There's a very cute story they say about a king who's informed by his prime minister that the grain in the land is infected. And everybody who eats it is going to become crazy, temporary insanity. And the Prime Minister says they did the test, it's verified, it's temporary. We'll eat it, it's this year's crop, we're all going to be crazy. But by next year, the new crop will be good, and everybody will be back to normal. What does it mean we're going to be crazy? Yeah, we're going to be crazy. We're going to put our food on the floor, we're going to eat like animals. I mean, we're going to be crazy for 1 year. The king says, you know, like, is there anything to do about this? And the prime minister says, sure, there's something. I stored up enough wheat from last year's crop for you and for me. So the rest of the country is going to be crazy, and we'll be normal. The king says in his benevolence, he says, I can't do that. If everybody else is crazy, we got to be crazy too. I can't do that. If they're eating from it and they're suffering, we have to suffer together. But this is what we'll do. I'll put a mark on my forehead, and you'll put a mark on your forehead. We'll all be crazy. But at least when I look at you and you look at me, at least we will know that we're crazy. Everybody else will think they're normal. We'll be just as crazy, but we'll know we're crazy. That, I believe, is Dover Emes Bilvavo. There are times in life that really you can't accept what's going on. It's not acceptable. But you can't really do anything about it right now because triage, you know. You got to figure out what you can handle. But a person has to repeat to themselves clearly the difference between right and wrong. I'll give you some examples. The Jews in the desert for 40 years, the greater part of 40 years, they did not circumcise their boys because they were always under the question, when would God say, travel? And they felt this is dangerous. It's an act of surgery. The child needs to recover. We're traveling, we're vulnerable. The winds, sandstorms, who knows? They didn't do it. When Joshua gets to the land of Israel after the 40 years in the desert, he does a mass circumcision, and then they're able to enter the land of Israel, then they're able to bring the Korban Pesach and celebrate properly. So you wonder, during those 40 years, incidentally, the tribe of Levi were the only ones who said, even so, we're going to do it. But for the majority of the Jewish people, they didn't do Bris Milah. That's Dover Emes Bilvavo. That's a person whose mission impossible. He's in a crisis situation. He can't do the mitzvah. He just can't do it right now. Either because he can't or because of legitimate reasons. He holds it's endangerment, and you don't have to do that particular mitzvah in an endangerment if it's going to cost a life. So they felt it's dangerous. So they didn't do it. But they remembered clearly, they repeated it to themselves, they knew we're on borrowed time, so to speak. This is not the correct way it's supposed to be. We're doing it because these are the circumstances. As soon as the circumstances change, we're going back to normal. Normal is observance of that mitzvah. I'll give you an example from more recent times. Jews came to this country. Many of them were observant in Europe. They got to the United States of that time, 6-day work week, which was Monday through Saturday, and they went into shock. How in the world are they going to support their families on a 6-day work week? There were some Jews who decided to become peddlers on Sunday, and they had their own thing Sunday through Friday. Many of them got arrested. There were blue laws, not allowed to run a business on Sunday. It's a day of worship in this country. So, you know, nowadays it's not a day of worship either, so they don't bother us. But for many Jews, they lost their jobs on Friday when they walked in and said to the boss, "Can I have my paycheck? I'm not coming in tomorrow. You're not coming in tomorrow. Don't come in on Monday." They lost their jobs. Many became entrepreneurs. They did their own thing. They owned their own shops because they had no choices. But for many, indeed, thousands and thousands, they felt that not having a job, being a greenhorn in this country without a job, was not a viable option for them. And they worked on Shabbos. They worked on Shabbos. They felt it was in danger. How are you going to put food on the table? But many of them waited dearly for the day that they could retire and they could stop working on Shabbos. Dover emes bilvavo, because they knew it was wrong. Historically, it's well known that people used to throw a kiddush on the Shabbos after they retired. When they finally could come back and join the rest of the Jewish community with Shabbos observance, they used to throw a kiddush. Celebration. Finally, I can come back. There's a fascinating prayer that Jewish women used to say. It's printed in some of the Techina booklets that were printed in the early 1900s. I translated it into English for one of the Jewish history courses. I'll read you a quick excerpt. The woman used to say, circa 1916, Hebrew Publishing Company, "I do not fault anyone. They work on Shabbos because they must in order to survive. But now, people are violating Shabbos as if that's the way it's supposed to be. You do it once, you do it twice, you think it's permitted. I ask of you, God, guard my husband, children from desecrating Shabbos and holidays. Grant us sustenance and comfort in a permissible way so that we never have to make your holidays as if they are weekdays." And that's this challenge that some people had. Many people, I'm thankful, my grandfather, great-grandfather, you know, they kept Shabbos no matter what. But those who didn't fell into two different categories. One category of people who just dropped it, and a different category that fulfilled the words of this psalm. Dover emes bilvavo. They bided their time. They waited. They knew. One day, I'm going to fix it. And those who did, so that's the mark on the forehead. At least you and I will know we're crazy. Until one day, we all get better. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Lo rogal al lishono. What does such a person do when he's offended? So number one, there's no slander on his tongue. That's not his reaction. He's a godly person. He's trying to build a godly tent. He doesn't speak badly about the people that have wronged him. Lo asal re'ehu ra'a. And likewise, when he has a relationship, a friend, he doesn't do bad. V'cherpa lo nasa al kirovo. And he does not cast disgrace upon a close one. We all know that the closer a relationship is, dissolution is more painful. A person who can hold up not only to the beginning of the verse, he didn't speak badly, he didn't do badly, but even Kurovo, a beloved person, something has to be worked out, someone who was close to you, so that defines the person. Great people were always very careful how to handle when there was a flare-up. There's an amazing story about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who was enormously big into ethics. He was on his way home to the city of Salant, where his real last name is Lipkin, but he's known as Salanter, from the city of Salant. So he was on the train home to Salant, and he tries to sit down in a spot, and a person who appeared to be an observant Jew was constantly insulting him. He tried to open the window. The guy makes a whole fuss how it's cold here and what an idiot would think of opening the window. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter promptly closes it and apologizes. He tries to read a book. He tries to do this, that. The guy has a million complaints. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter kept his cool. It was tough. He figures this guy is apparently troubled by something. He gets home and he finds out that there's a person who made an appointment as soon as he gets home. This man wants to meet him. Person's coming in from a different town. He wants to get a certification that he can be a shochet, a ritual slaughterer. It's a big endorsement. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says, fine, I'll be glad to meet him. And in walks this man from the train who is insulted. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter kept his cool. He said, don't worry about it. Sit down. The guy's all embarrassed. I didn't realize you were the great Rabbi Salanter. Fine. Sit down. No problem. He starts giving the guy the test. And the guy does not know the material. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter figured, you know, maybe he's nervous. He's tired from the trip. He forgot things. He says, why don't you review? Come back in a week. The guy comes back in a week. He still doesn't know it. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter assigned one of his students to learn with the young man until he would be able to pass the test. And eventually he passed. He got the certificate. And the students asked him, you know, why? Why couldn't you just flunk him and send him on his way? And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, I couldn't do that because if I did, there would be a little bit of revenge in my behavior, in my emotions. A little bit. I got him back. What absurd behavior he had to me on the train. And I can't do that. My only solution here, I can't give him an endorsement if he doesn't deserve it. My only choice was to bring him up until he could pass. And then I could give him the endorsement and have a clean slate. That's a greatness that Pasuk Gimel is describing. That even when the person wrongs you, you figure out a different way to handle the situation. Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Nivze be'enav nim'os. People who are bad are repulsive. He's got his scores straight. You know, sometimes we watch in a community how someone who is repulsive is honored, either because they have money or they have connections or whatever. And then at the dinner, you hear all these glorious things about them. And you personally know that this is one big mess. The house is a mess. The business is a mess. A person has to know what the truth is. There has to be clarity. If the person is wrong, so to you, you need to know that. And the flip side, and people who fear God, people who are sincere, good people, I don't care how popular they are, I will honor them because I know who they are. Nishba lahara velo yomir. Honesty, integrity is so clear to me that even if I were to swear something that was bad for me, I made a commitment that was bad for me, I would come through with it. Because I know you got to do the right thing. Even if it's inconvenient. Finally, Pasuk Hei. Kaspo v'nosan b'neshech. Person lends money but not with interest. So this is a fascinating concept. By rights, according to Judaism, you would have the right to charge interest. All of the banking system is based on that. It's my money. If you want it, you think you can make money, you think you can do something great with it, so pay me rent. You borrow my car. There's a concept of rental. You borrow my house. There's a concept called rental. You borrow my money. Rental. Percentage. Whatever the arrangement is. The Torah, however, tells us that there's an important facet of chesed, of kindness. It comes to money. It's mandated that we don't charge interest between Jews. That's a courtesy. House, car, we mentioned. Sometimes yes, sometimes not. Person comes for Shabbos, you know. We don't generally charge rent. I guess you could create a Shabbos apartment somewhere, but I mean, basically, hospitality among the Jews, for the most part, we don't charge rent, but someone could, theoretically could. You lend out your car. We generally don't charge, but you could. You could create a rental business. Rents out cars. Not a problem. When it comes to money between Jews, we don't charge interest. The only way, parenthetically, that you could charge interest would be to create a business relationship in which you become an investor in whatever it is that he is investing. He wants to borrow money to start up a grocery, so you become a partner in the grocery, and therefore it pays dividends. But to go ahead and charge him interest straight away, that's a level of generosity that's expected of us. And David describes that as classic of a person who's giving, generous, even when it hurts, so to speak. Even when you're taking something of mine, and I would like to get paid for it. V'shochar al naki lo lakach, and he doesn't take a bribe against the innocent. And the commentaries say, he doesn't even take a bribe, not against the innocent, not in favor of the innocent. He doesn't take bribes. The first part of the pasuk was that he's giving generously. The second part of the pasuk is that he's cautious with what he takes. Osa Eila, the concluding statement is, people who do this, lo yimot la'olam, will never falter. Forgetting about falling, but they won't even, you know, like, lose their balance. A person like this can move forward smoothly. Now, you'll look at this chapter and you'll say, whoa, he's got 11 things here that I got to become experts in. And the rabbi said, that's just the starting point. Well, it is the starting point. The Medrash says that Rabbi Gamliel was stunned when he read this and he started crying. What's the hope? I'm going to be an expert at all 11? How am I going to get my tent? How am I going to get my permanent residence of holiness? And Rabbi Akiva said something very beautiful. Rabbi Akiva said, the same word, Eile, these, is used by the laws of impurity. It says that if you touch this type of animal carcass, that type of thing, a whole list of things, if you touch these, then you become impure. So Rabbi Akiva said, we know that you don't have to touch all of them to become impure. If you touch any one of these items, you have to purify yourself before entering the Temple Mount. So Rabbi Akiva said, the same way that it says, Eile by impurity, and touching even one requires purification. So he says the same way when it says, Eile over here, these, any one of these is a fair starting point. And Rabbi Gamliel accepted that statement, any one is a fair starting point. And he said, Nichamtanu, Akiva Nichamtanu, you've comforted me, Akiva. And if the great Rabbi Gamliel, who was a great person, he probably was an expert at all of these, but he was overwhelmed. So we're entitled to be overwhelmed too when we look at all these things, if we delve into them, spend time with them. But Rabbi Akiva said, start with any one. And you can create a sanctified tent, which progressively, magic trick of life, produces that which you guide yourself towards.
Which the politicians would think of this.
Our job is us. That's our job. Everything else is added bonus. Now, in order to get the most out of a chapter, you got to recite it audibly and preferably multiple times. Person takes one chapter, makes it their favorite, says it every day, whatever. That's the theme of what we do with Shmona Esrei. It's the theme with all Jewish prayer, that we reach a point where the words flow. We're not sitting there at that point agonizing over the pronunciation. It flows. And we could start letting our minds think about the translation. And when we get good at that, the concepts run through our mind. And we do finally, it's the third session, I finally timed it, that we have time to recite it together, which was the original goal. So if you'll just join me from the beginning, from verse 1, I'm going to recite it in the Hebrew. You could follow the Hebrew in Hebrew, the Hebrew in the English, or simply recite it in straight English if that's more comfortable. Let's begin. As you're doing it, pay attention to the translation. Mizmor l'David Adonai Mi yagur be'ahalecha Mi yishkon behar kodshecha Holeich tamim ufo'el tzedek v'dover emes bilvavo Lo ragal al lishono, lo asa lureihu ra'a, v'cherpa lo nasa al kirovo, nivze be'enav nim'os, v'es yirei Adonai Yichabed Nishba Lehara Velo Yamir Kaspo Lo Nosan Beneshech Vishochad Al Noki Lo Lakoch Osei Eile Lo Yimot Leolam. Beautiful. It's been a pleasure. Keep in mind, whenever you say Tehillim, Hashem authored 5 books of Torah, gave them to us through Moshe. Tehillim is also 5 books. It's David on behalf of mankind as a response. And this chapter in particular is the response. David addresses Hashem, contemplating, trying to figure out, what do we need to do to build that tent in this world that will give us the permanent residence in the world to come? I hope that all of us will find this chapter that much more meaningful, and that you will all be blessed with this type of blessing, the holy tent, which finds fruition for yourself and for your families. Question.
One of the verses you said there.